Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I can't quit you, babe. But I've got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connell. I can't even say my own name. It's Halloween. I've been dipping into the Halloween candy a little early, my friends. I apologize. Patrick Connor, now that I have a grasp on my own name here, from Knuckles and Gloves, Fight City, Oregonian, a couple other places, and in just a minute, going to have my buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler on here, author, filmmaker, roamer of city streets. He's going to be with us. Look, Bryn has spent the last, I think, couple days in Alabama. I apologize, Bryn. He spent the last couple days in Alabama covering Deontay Wilder's training camp for his upcoming fight against Tyson Fury. So we're going to be talking a lot about that today. You guys are going to get a little bit of an inside look at his training camp, of his life, lifestyle, etc. We've done this before. Bryn has visited Roy Jones Jr. for a little extended stay in Roy Jones' rooster chicken coop. Bryn has gone out and hung out with chess champions. Bryn has been out and about. Where else was he? Somewhat recently, it was maybe a year and a half ago with Andre Ward in the lead up to one of the Sergey Kovalev fights, kind of just hanging out with Andre Ward. So anyway, point is he's got a little bit of an inside track on Deontay Wilder, the Bomb Squad and whatnot. But otherwise, today we're going to be recapping the victory by Daniel Jacobs over Sergey Derevyanchenko on HBO last weekend. Just kind of going through the ins and outs of what we thought of the HBO production, you know, what the direction that's going in, and HBO and boxing, that is, and what that all means, what the win for Daniel Jacobs means for boxing, what it means for the middleweight division, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so I just took a long-ass time covering what exactly we're going to be talking about today. But as everybody knows, HBO has been more or less backing out of the boxing business. It seems like it's kind of been a bit of a slow thing. It's been a slow bleed. Like I've mentioned a handful of times over the last few shows, the budget for boxing on HBO has fallen and fallen and fallen over the last handful of years. And I mean, I just don't know how anybody can know that and can acknowledge that and say, oh, well, now it's fine. They'll make do with what they got. Oh, they slashed their budget by 35% this year. Ah, it's fine. I'm sure they'll make it the same amount of fights and the fights will be just as good. It's impossible, especially with the changing landscape of purses and boxing and, the financial aspects of boxing always kind of in flux. And with HBO slowly bowing out and kind of, bleeding themselves out of the boxing game, that's left a massive gap. A few gaps, actually. And DAZN has stepped in and filled at least one of those gaps. And actually, coming up in the next week, we have, I believe, another kind of one of those gaps. Sullivan Barrera fights Shawnee Monaghan on Facebook. So that's another way in which this is kind of... been transitioned, as it were. So what we had been told, though, when HBO had kind of announced their exit from boxing, as it were, what we had been told was that, well, no, HBO is still going to be in boxing. They're just going to be picking up fights that are, really good fights or worth the buy or whatever the case may be, and that's kind of not really been the case. They already had Daniel Jacobs versus Sergey Derevyanchenko scheduled, so that doesn't really count, but since this announcement, they've picked up Dmitry Bivol versus Jean Pascal, so that's not really giving me a whole lot of confidence. It doesn't really give me a whole lot of confidence as far as what they're going to be investing in boxing over the next, months or whatever. I don't know. It's really tough to say where exactly they're going with this stuff. But that being said, let's get Bryn's take on this stuff. Bryn, what's up, dude?
Things are good. Things are good. I was gonna do my best attempt at a Tuscaloosa, Alabama accent and talk about the chicken and waffles I had this morning. Yeah, God, he does that a lot, and it's been interesting down here. I've never been to Tuscaloosa before, right beside the Black Warrior River, flowing underneath the bridge to Northport. Tuscaloosa news outside my window. What other things can I comment upon? Excessively good barbecue in Tuscaloosa. Just a heads up if you pass through. Dreamland or Archibald is like the big separation of where you stand. Like there's one group that says Archibald is the only place to go. It's 56 years old, and it's the same oven where they cook slabs. And then Dreamland is the other camp. So I've only tried one so far, but probably Dreamland tonight. And the rest of the time it's been all Deontay, your favorite fighter.
I don't know. This whole Dreamland business has got me kind of reminiscent. Look, Dreamland used to be a venue in, well, it's a venue in a number of different cities, but notably in San Francisco, many, many decades ago, a famed boxing venue. So I don't know. I'm kind of leaning in Dreamland, but I'd have to taste some barbecue to really know. And I have zero problem doing that. I love barbecue.
It's really good.
So, quick question, though, as far as Deontay Wilder goes. So, I was bringing up at the start of the show. Look, dude, you called us from from Roy Jones' chicken coop one time. So, you're really, like, in the mix here. But you spent some time with Andre Ward. I mean, you've spent time with a number of different fighters. And kind of, that seems to kind of, in a way, not just fighters, too, some chess champions. It seems to kind of be your thing, immersing yourself into the life of whoever it is that you're covering to get a better idea of what it is their life's about, and not just, you know, interviewing them for 10 minutes over the phone is a fighter and I'm a writer, and there's nothing wrong with that. But obviously, like I said, this kind of is your thing. Like you're really diving in. And when you had mentioned you're with Roy Jones, it seemed like everybody knew Roy Jones around his hometown. When you were with Andre Ward, a lot of people seemed to know Andre Ward, perhaps not as many, but a lot of people did. What's the feeling you get with Deontay Wilder in Tuscaloosa?
It's fascinating. It's a fascinating place because I think what I had a little time to him on my own yesterday where it was just me and him in a room alone. I was given an allotted period of time and it expanded because when you get somebody alone and they drop their guard a little bit and you catch them off guard with some questions, it's always interesting to see them step out of the role that they've been creating. And for me, I mean, the bomb squad and Deontay wearing a mask and a lot of his demeanor, it's just not, it's like kabuki theater or like shitty wrestling kind of stuff. And I like wrestling, but it's just, it's a shitty version of it to me. So to see him talk about the first time he ever got in an airplane in his life was because of boxing, because he had to go to Colorado and then go to Beijing. So it was the reason he got his first passport. Talking about where he grew up across the street from an elementary school, I asked them, tell me the first address that you remember living in. And he describes this greenhouse, and it's across the street from Stillman Elementary. I'm going to go there today. I was looking at it on Google Maps. We've heard the stuff about his daughter and spina bifida, and it's that's an interesting narrative for sure. But the other thing for me was to ask him yesterday, what if you're the last great American heavyweight? What if you take out Fury? What if you take out Joshua? And people give you your props, because a lot of the great heavyweights were not seen as great when they won the title. Ali was a big underdog against Liston. George Foreman was a big underdog against Joe Frazier. Tyson was a favorite, but there's a lot of other cases where we had to have some space after they were gone to appreciate what they did. Joe Lewis is another one, lost his first amateur fight when he beat Braddock. He was knocked down early, and I think a lot of people were like, he's a bum or whatever, and then he stays champ for 12 years, 25 fights, defending his title. So, and people denigrated the kind of people that he fought at the time, the Bum of the Month Club, but it's interesting to me how these guys can be moving targets. You don't know what you're looking at because history is going to have a different take, and so I wanted to give Deontay the benefit of the doubt because what most intrigued me about wanting to interview him was just a throwaway comment a commentator made, which is to say, it's really hard to figure a guy out who hasn't figured himself out. And here's an interesting fact about Deontay Wilder. When Deontay Wilder was 23 years old, fighting his first professional fight, he was exactly the same age that Joe Lewis was, fighting James Braddock to win the heavyweight title. And I can't think of any other sport where you could walk into it at 20 years old, pick it up, and go on to become an elite representative who's making millions of dollars. And it's not just that in boxing he can do it, it's that the heavyweight division of boxing in this era. Mark Breland, his assistant trainer, was there. He was watching everything. And I asked him, when did you put on your first pair of gloves? And he said, 8 years old. At what skill level is Deontay Wilder now to what you were as you were developing? And he looked at me and he kind of smiled and he said, he's about where I was at 11.
Hey.
And I mean,
he's honest.
He's honest, and he's not lying, and he wasn't trying to denigrate Wilder. It's just, if you were a welterweight coming up in the early 1980s,
yeah.
Breland, I think, had an amateur record of 124-1 and then wins the gold medal.
Easily, widely considered one of the greatest American amateurs of all time.
No question. And he just said to me, I said, can you imagine what it would be like if you had your skills as a heavyweight? And he said, I do imagine it. I could beat Anthony Joshua. Look at that guy. Look at the way he fights. He doesn't have any tools. But we're in an era where that's okay. All you have to do is be able to bang, and you're going to be fine. And so it was really interesting because he likes Wilder, and he's supporting him. He's giving him his advice. But his attitude is just, this era is bonkers with just how basic the people are that are competing. And I think Wilder knows that too. Wilder was a lot smarter than I thought he was. He wasn't playing the stupid role. There's intelligence there, there's sensitivity there, and I found him really, really likable, which surprised me, frankly. I didn't go in thinking I would dislike him. I respect all these guys, but I found him a lot more compelling than I thought as a person behind this, the act that he's putting on to try to sell shit. And I got him at the end of the day. I've never done this with a fighter in my life. I never take pictures with fighters or any that shit. I got him to recreate the Neil Leifer photo of Ali standing over Sonny Liston as if he's knocked me out.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So I just thought, if this guy knocks everybody out, I want just a little memento for one time. And I couldn't stop laughing. And he was like, stop laughing. And then he starts tickling me while I'm on the fucking ground. So he's fun. Like, he's fun. I think there's a good guy there, despite that we know there's a lot of darkness and shit there too.
Have you been able to broach the subject of a one Charlie Zelenoff?
He did talk about Charlie Zelenoff, and I was there yesterday, and the day before is when I arrived in Tuscaloosa and watched his sparring, beginning of his sparring. He had excellent sparring partners, Kazakhstani two-time bronze medalist from the Olympics, Junior Faw from New Zealand, and then another guy, Malik. Fuck, am I getting it right? Something Malik. He was a – I think Wilder beat him early in his career.
Malik Scott?
I'm sorry. Malik Scott. Those are the three. And Wilder fought seven rounds the first day, and I think 8 rounds yesterday. And it was rough. I mean, it was some rough sparring. There were some moments where, as Michael Bent once famously told me, the words that changed his life is, when he was sparring with Evander Holyfield, George Benton said, I can't tell who the champion is when you're sparring. There were a few moments that were a little like that, watching some of these young guys with Wilder. Who was the champion? Who was winning rounds? It wasn't clear to tell, and maybe that's just because it was the beginning of sparring, but it was interesting.
You know, but that's one of the really deceptive things about Deontay Wilder, though, dude. And that's something that, look, I took a long time for me to kind of come around on him. And I'm not going to say I'm his biggest fan. I'm not going to say I all of a sudden think he's super skilled or that he's even the best heavyweight right now. But I was definitely in the camp of people who were like, this guy's pretty much a joke. And as soon as he steps in with somebody for real, he's going to get knocked out. And look at me. I'm Mr. Wrongy. He's shown, before Luis Ortiz, he had shown that he was capable of hurting a lot of heavyweights, knocking out a lot of heavyweights. He'd also shown that he had been knocked down, or perhaps not knocked down before, but or previously anyway, but he had been, at the very least, hurt and wobbled pretty good and outboxed by a number of guys who, just being just not, you know, not mincing words, are not that good. Arthur Spielka, Eric Molina, you know, he had a hell of a time with Johan Duaupau. A number of these guys, there were at least rounds or chunks of time where it was like, oh shit, seriously? But, like I said, the deceptive thing is that he still wound up winning, and he still wound up at some point knocking the shit out of all these guys. But it wasn't until he did it against Luis Ortiz where I was like, all right, I have to reluctantly give this guy a heap of credit here, because he was able to do what he did against these other scrubs against somebody who was actually pretty good. And not only did he do that, but he was on the brink of, like, getting put to sleep himself. And that's not a good thing. You know, it's not good to get hurt like that. But you have to give a guy credit when he goes to that point and then is able to seize victory back. Like, that's not something that happens all the time in boxing, and that should be recognized. So, and again, I don't want to heap too much praise on him for that, but it deserves some praise. And it deserves some consideration when talking about where he is in the heavyweight division and you know, who he could potentially beat. And, you know, it's easy to dismiss him as a bum and all this type of stuff, but I think that he's shown that, yeah, he's obviously vulnerable. Yes, he might be knocked out by somebody like Anthony Joshua, but if they are not careful, he might literally sing him a little lullaby.
It was totally surreal watching him shadowbox, watching 2 rounds of him dancing around the ring, because I was just thinking, 11 years watching Cuba's Best in their preparation, I've never seen such a maladroit display of skills when I'm watching him. I was just like, his legs are that of like a super flyweight. They're so small. It's amazing how small he is. How unlike not just a heavyweight champion, but a heavyweight boxer is, and the way he moves, there are moments where Logan Paul was having his exhibition fight or charity fight or whatever, where he looked like a more seasoned, skilled fighter than many moments of Deontay Wilder. I don't think that's an exaggeration. And how is that possible? It's possible because the moment he throws his right hand and you see how fast it is and how dangerous it is, he can land it on anybody, and if it hits anybody, they're out. Whoever they are, they're out. But on the other hand, if you talk to Mark Breland and you say, and a lot of British media types were at his gym, in Northport and you'd say to them, what would Lennox Lewis do in this era? They just laugh their heads off, because an actual complete fighter who's a very well-schooled fighter would annihilate these guys. I mean, I think Butterbean, it's safe to say, would be a top 20 heavyweight in this era of heavyweight boxing. I think he could be a top 10 heavyweight, because he could hit. He could hit, and who knows? So it's interesting just that Wilder has this cartoonish weapon of a right hand, but you think – I agree with you about the Ortiz fight. Prior to that, it was like, who has he fought? Wilder has been fighting professionally for 10 years, and who has he fought? it's not a very good resume. And then he steps up to fight somebody that none of the other guys want to fight and faces some adversity, but in the end puts him away, and nobody's ever done that to Ortiz before. So he does deserve the credit, and I just feel like at both ends of the spectrum in terms of saying, I've never seen a worse heavyweight champion than a lot of things he shows me, and yet I see a right hand that could destroy any Hall of Fame heavyweight that's ever fought.
That's exactly the paradox of it, you know, and it's a paradox that's inherent to boxing, and especially heavyweight boxing, where, you know, the old, well, anybody could knock him out, you know, that type of stuff. Like, for the most part in boxing, that's not true. That type of stuff, like, well, one punch could end at any time. For the vast, vast majority of fights, that's not true. But often in heavyweight boxing, it is. And I don't see a whole lot of heavyweights in history eating that right hand and just going, yeah, okay. I think most of them are going to go, oh, shit, I shouldn't be taking a whole lot of those, if not just going right to sleep. And the thing is, though, of course, that he's wide open to take what they got. You know, is Joe Lewis, one of the greatest combination punchers of all time, it catches Deontay Wilder with a nasty five-piece, you know, he might go to sleep too. So it's, anyway, like I said, it's the weird paradox, especially of Deontay Wilder here. But in training, you mentioned him being just kind of gangly. So he's no less gangly in training than he is in the ring.
Oh, no. I mean, I've never, like, all three of his opponents are these big guys who are meant to replicate Fury, right? The Kazakhstani fighter is undefeated. I think he's had 7 pro fights. He's knocked out everybody. He's 6'8 or 6'9, 250. Junior Faw from New Zealand, 6'5, 250. Malik Scott, 6'4, maybe 270. I mean, he doesn't look like he's in the greatest condition. And if you look at their lower bodies, like you don't watch their upper bodies, it's like their legs, their thighs, and their calves are twice the size of Wilder's. Like, and not exaggerating, twice the size. I wouldn't even be surprised if their circumference was literally twice the size of him. And he did talk about it, and he just said, everybody thinks you need to bulk up to do this, do that. I don't do it. I don't listen to anybody about what I should look like or how I should fight. Look at the results of what I've been doing. I've been doubted my entire life. I've always worked hard. Before boxing came into my life, I was working 3 jobs. I wasn't making enough money as a pro fighter, so I was still working 2nd jobs. So that was a sense I had of him, that work ethic and discipline, and his trainer reiterated this, like he is working really hard. He doesn't do road work, which is kind of funny, because he's just openly like, fuck that shit. Like, why? I'm in shape all the time. I don't need to run. I get in a pool, and it's true. Like, you look at his build, he looks like a teenager who's in great shape. He doesn't have, like, that man build where he's filled out. So it's really unusual to sort of take his measure as a physical specimen, and great heavyweights, like, it's impossible not to be in awe of them. But you look at him, and it felt much more similar to be standing next to him or kind of goofing around with him, with like basketball players, big and tall, but skinny, and you feel like you could sort of push them over. But then he throws that right hand, and you're just kind of like, oh wow, that's probably a bigger right hand than Lennox Lewis. Where did he get that from? Because he can't do anything else.
Like, I mean, he doesn't jab very effectively. His hook looks ridiculous. His footwork is very strange and clumsy. But at any moment, he can throw a right hand with this tremendous wingspan and just generate such incredible power. And you just think, there's no legs behind it. There's nothing from the snap of turning his hips and getting that weight into it that is offering any kind of power or weight. But yet, when you see its effect and you hear it, like, I, you know, in a gym that's closed off and you hear him, you know, even missing, you can hear the sound, like wafting. It's like somebody missing on a shot that would go 550 feet in baseball, like a home run. There's it's majestic. But almost everything else, not only is it not majestic, it's just so pedestrian. It just looks like a guy, yeah, I play basketball. I want to give boxing a try. I feel like sparring today. At moments, he looks like that guy. And he's been doing this for 10 years. It's amazing.
That's crazy. And like you said earlier, it's crazy that in any major sport, well, I guess it's kind of arguable how major boxing is, but in any, you know, sport that makes a lot of money, that anyone can start at such a late age, such a late stage in life and get to that point. It's pretty amazing. And it's pretty amazing that that a sport like boxing allows that kind of opportunity, you know. As far as Wilder and, like, does Mark Breland give you any indication in as far as Wilder and his, like, development? Like, you said earlier that when you had asked Breland about what stage Wilder was at compared to him, you know, he's only maybe about 3 years on or so. But yep. Does Breland, or Wilder for that matter, give you any indicator of, like, where he thinks he's developing or where Breland feels he's developing in relation to the rest of the division? Like, does he feel like there needs to still be more, or does he feel like, you know, he's pretty much right in line and he's not going to have much of a problem?
Yeah, it was more the latter. I mean, Breland, I wasn't expecting that either. I thought there'd be, you know, a big elaborate explanation about sophisticated training methods, but watching his trainer at ringside as Deontay, while he's not throwing, you just hear a lot of encouragement. That's it, Deontay. That's it, D. That's it, D. You're working on the little things. Looking good, looking good. And I'm not seeing anything that's happening. Nothing. I'm just seeing a guy standing there waiting to punch. So I'm like, what are you seeing that I'm not seeing? Because I've been around a lot of really good fighters, and you can see the sort of micro movements and fainting and all that kind of stuff. That's not Wilder. Like, Wilder is not that nuanced. We're not on a micro level of him, you know, deconstructing these sparring partners. It's just, should I throw the right hand? Should I throw a hook? Move, move, move. Should I throw a left hand? Should I throw a right? Like, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of strategy to his game. And so Breland just seemed to be like, the era we're in, just land first. What did he say? You're in this division, you're either going to give it or you're going to get it. So we're just trying to help him to give it. Okay. Like, you know, it was just really weird, because when you're watching the World Series and you're thinking, I could never, if you've ever been in a batting cage, hitting a 60-mile-an-hour pitch takes a little while. If you don't have a background in baseball, it's hard. And when it's 70, you just can't see anything, let alone 80, let alone 90, let alone 100. It's just unthinkable to be able to do anything meaningful with that coming at you. And yet with boxing in the heavyweight division right now, especially, there is just this element of how basic these guys are. And I heard one English journalist say, after watching him spar for 5 rounds, if he can't knock Fury out, he's going to be boxed to death, because there's just – Fury can box. Fury is a difficult guy to deal with if you can't take him out. And a lot of Wilder's defense still is just leaning back. And I was thinking a lot about Michael Grant versus Lennox Lewis, that once Michael Grant was in there with somebody that, like, knew how to control distance, had a significant wingspan, could come forward, could find angles, you know, he was unraveled in 2 minutes, in a minute. And I'm not saying that's going to happen to Wilder. I'm just saying it could very easily happen to him where somebody like Fury could just win round after round after round unless Wilder can start hurting him. And there's a certain degree of passivity in Wilder's game at times, which I don't really understand because stamina doesn't seem to be an issue. But, you know, in 16 rounds of sparring, I only saw him throw his right hand maybe 3 or 4 times, which kind of puzzled me.
Hmm. An injury, maybe?
He said he was not feeling great, and he made that point that he said, you guys need to appreciate, leaned over the ropes, you guys need to appreciate we are never going into the ring 100%. I'm in a lot of pain. I'm sore. I'm stiff. I think he said he'd had 8 operations, which made me immediately think of Andre Ward saying that he lives every moment of his life in pain, and he's still a relatively young guy. I guess they're about the same age, 32, 33 years old. Wilder just turned 33. But yeah, you know, he seems – he keeps saying he feels really sore, but after he finished sparring, he was very amiable and friendly, and I liked him when he wasn't putting on his show. Like the moment they brought Instagram, like they were filming shit for Instagram, or he was watching Fury videos, and he readily admits he likes Fury. He just seemed like a likable guy, and told a couple anecdotes about going back to his old neighborhood on the West side or the West end of Tuscaloosa and seeing all the same people there from when he was growing up. And he made this statement. He went there in a Bentley and said, you all still here? And he saw their faces drop and he realized that he didn't mean it the way they took it. He meant it just like, you guys are still here. Not I'm driving here in a Bentley because I'm making millions of dollars fighting and you guys haven't done fucking fuck all with your life. And it affected him. It really fucked with his head to don't go in this direction of like, this is where you're from. This is the town where you're from. Very humble beginnings. Your dad was a pastor. His father was a pastor. You've got these kids to look after. And he just made a point that he's trying to extricate as much drama from his life as he can and be grateful. And I know it sounds like I'm doing PR for him, but there seemed to be more self-awareness than there usually is with a lot of these guys caught in the glare of one fight away from, you know, making life-changing money, 50 million, you know, major life-changing money, generational life-changing money with a Joshua fight. And he said he'd be happy to fight Ortiz again. He said, I like fighting these guys that nobody else wants to fight. And even though I beat him, nobody still wants to fight him. So I want to leave behind a legacy of unifying all the titles. And, you know, there was a sign on the wall that said, here are the champions who didn't last very long at all. And here are the champions that endured. And he put his own name on the slate on the right-hand side of the ones who lasted a long time. There's another sign that said, the next heavyweight champion of the world, Deontay Wilder, home of the next champion of the world. And he crossed it out, title, and it said, the heavyweight champion of the world. This is kind of fun because it was just such a little gym. There's stray cats running around. It's in the middle of being shaded by a bunch of pine trees. It's just such a... It's still kind of amazing that America can produce a kid from nowhere, and I'm not trying to say Tuscaloosa is nowhere, but I just mean rough circumstances where a lot of America would see it as nowhere. And
well, it's certainly not considered a big boxing city. So
it's certainly
in that
not
context, for sure.
Yeah, and you know, look who his sparring partners are. They're almost all foreigners. You know, they're all to find the 6'5", 250-pound guys with an elite amateur pedigree. They're not from America anymore. They're not. And they were talking about how difficult it is to find proper sparring for Wilder. And they're all flown in from a long ways away because in America, these guys, you know, all anybody talks about in Tuscaloosa is Alabama football. You know, everywhere you go, I'm seeing almost as many Alabama
Roll
University
Tide
flags. Yeah, Roll Tide. that you go under a bridge that says fucking Roll Tide to get to his gym. It's like a big bridge where a train goes over top and there's a sign that says Roll Tide and Alabama flags in front of a lot of houses, as many as you see American flags. And it's very different for me, despite being from the deep south of Canada, as you know. There's a different way of doing things up there.
Yeah, well, it's just a little bit more greenery down there and more Roll Tide than you're used to, huh? Yeah? Well, a little bit different for you. Yeah, it's, I mean, so Deontay Wilder, for me anyway, there are guys who you get the feeling that they don't really want the challenge. You know, that they're perfectly comfortable skating along. To me, Deontay Wilder, does seem like he wants to fight those other fighters. I don't think that there's any, I mean, I don't see any, I don't get any sense that he doesn't really want to or anything like that. But as we've talked about numerous times before, the promotional sagas and, you know, rifts and blah, 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 has he opened up about that at all? Has he opened up about his representation and promotional stuff? Because in the last maybe year or so, it seems like more and more fighters are expressing frustration with Premier Boxing Champions, expressing frustration with their just inactivity and kind of, well, that kind of stuff. But here we are with Deontay Wilder. He fought once in March and it was a big fight and he got hurt pretty good, but he's, you know, now 9 months later fighting. He fought twice in 2017, twice in 2016. In some ways, sadly, he's actually probably one of the busier of the Premier Boxing Champions fighters because he is a heavyweight with a world title. So has he mentioned any of that kind of stuff at all?
He did mention some frustration about that he was, you know, trying to make the fights. He called out Joshua a number of times to say that Joshua didn't want the fight. And that he says he wants respect. He says there's a reason why he goes out of his way to knock people out, because that's how he wants to be known, because he knows these other guys don't take these risks that he's willing to take. And I didn't have enough time to really go into the Al Haymon versus Eddie Hearn. I don't really see financially how it's possible for the two of them to fight in the near future, just because the whole business foundation of signing somebody like Joshua to DAZN is to get as many subscribers as possible. So you're not going to just let him go over to Showtime. And the same with Showtime allowing Wilder to go over and fight on DAZN. So I think there's going to be some real problems there to make that happen, which is very frustrating. And I do believe he wants the fight. I don't get a sense. I think Ortiz is the proof. Ortiz is a terrible matchup for Deontay Wilder. Terrible. This guy has seen everything. He's a southpaw. He can knock you out. He can move. Yes, he's 600 years old. But other than that he's 600 years old, he's a tremendous fighter with a tremendous resume and very, very dangerous. And we saw that with him almost knocking Wilder out. But I think Breland told me that when he saw Wilder come back to the corner after almost getting stopped, he saw his eyes and he thought, he's out. Like, he's not here right now. He doesn't know where he is. So he lifted his boxing trunks in front of his groin and dumped a bucket of water. And then Wilder came to and was like, oh, yeah, okay. Okay, I'm here. which is funny. But
let me pour some water on your balls.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think he deserves, you know, the credit of not just that fight, but also demonstrating his willingness to, you know, take any challenge. That was, I think you could make an argument that taking Ortiz was it was up there with taking on Fury at his peak or even Joshua. I think maybe Ortiz could be as dangerous as a Joshua. I don't know that Ortiz doesn't win that fight against Joshua. If they fought 10 times, I could see Ortiz winning three of them, two or three of them. He's really dangerous.
He is. And I mean, it's kind of tricky, as you know, with Cuban fighters, especially, it's really tricky figuring out what their actual ring age is. And you don't know that they're like done until like they're done right in front of you. And then that's it. And they ain't coming back. And it's like, so Luis Ortiz is, I don't know, he's what, like 39 or something like that. But physically, at least thus far, we haven't seen any indication that he is 39 in the ring. He still looks like he hasn't really taken a whole ton of damage, and he still looks like he's kind of ready to go. But that could change literally at any time. So, I mean, yeah, he's older, but I don't want to just kind of ride the Deontay Wilder bandwagon here. But anyway, like I said earlier, it was kind of – I felt that that was convincing. That was definitely a fight where, you know, you kind of trial by fire, run the gauntlet, however you want to characterize it. That, to me, when I'm looking at the development of a fighter, is far more important than seeing a guy constantly dominate. Seeing Roy Jones, for instance, almost look as like nobody ever takes a round from him. Nobody's ever really even catching him, type of shit. That speaks more to the opposition than how good a person is. You know, you just look at the history of boxing and the history of great fighters. You know, these guys take punches, and if they're not taking punches, something's wrong. So looking at Deontay Wilder's development as a fighter, that Luis Ortiz fight was really important to me, and it really was a demonstration of like, okay, this guy's for real. He's not just some dude that's here beating up on scrubs, and well, he is a dude beating up on scrubs, but that's not all he is. At least, you know, that's what the Luis Ortiz fight proved to me. But as we've said several times, it's just a question of maybe that's what Mark Breland was saying, you know, who lands first in this division. And so we got to make sure that Deontay Wilder is the one landing first, which is kind of funny, though, because that's not really what his style has developed into. He's not really an attack, attack, attack guy. He's actually developed a little bit more into a misguided counterpuncher. You know, like he's got pretty quick hands, but he hasn't quite settled into that comfort of knowing where those punches are and where those punches are going to be yet. So, I mean, it's kind of funny to watch in that way, and that's probably why he looks so awkward. But, yeah, he's not really the kind of guy who's on the attack against this upper, you know, echelon that he's been facing in the last handful of fights.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I think it's a very interesting situation of what he represents. Cause I mean, as you and I are trying to parse now, we've been trying to parse, like, he could get blown out against Fury and I wouldn't be shocked, or he could blow out Fury, or it could be a long fight where he loses a decision. He could go in there against Joshua. I really don't know what's going to happen. I think they're both in a very precarious position in many ways. Also, they could knock each other out in the first round. It could go the distance. It could be kind of an ugly fight. I'll give you one bit of insight from the sparring that I thought was a gross oversight on the part of his trainers, especially with Fury. There was no clinching. There was no infighting in like 15, 16 rounds of them sparring. There was maybe one clinch for about 3 seconds. And the idea that they're not preparing for an ugly fight with Fury, I think is really, really dangerous for Wilder. Because I think Fury is crazy not to make it the ugliest fight possible. Not to go like as John Ruiz as possible. You know, if you and I were in his corner, I'd just be like, don't ever stand in front of him at a distance where you're going to get caught by something, especially that you've done your fucking weight loss and, you know, stopped drinking, been on the wagon for 6 months. You're not in condition to like fight the way you used to fight at 25, being relatively clean. Make this as ugly as possible. And that wasn't how he was sparring, how Wilder was sparring. It was just really standing in front of each other and exchanging jabs and slowly moving around. They were trying to mimic Fury a little bit with like silly cartoonish antics, like putting the hands behind the back, but they didn't get at mimicking what Fury does well and effectively and has allowed him to be as successful as he is. And that seemed pretty reckless to me.
From a strategic standpoint, I think that could wind up being a pretty big mistake. Because, I mean, well, you don't even really need to go very far in Tyson Fury's resume. I mean, I've been kind of talking shit about Deontay Wilder and his opponents. But, hey, dude, if you go beyond Vladimir Klitschko on Tyson Fury's resume, it thins out very quickly. But you don't need to go farther than that. Just look at the Vladimir Klitschko fight. And all respect to Tyson Fury, that was a fantastic display of knowing the strategy and carrying it out. He started very early in the fight with his feints. It seemed to me like he was aware that Vladimir Klitschko would have great difficulty with a guy who was taller than him and had as much range as he did, which he did. And as soon as he was able to start landing early in the first round, he immediately started working his feints, and Vladimir Klitschko bought them the entire fight after that. And to me, that was like, okay, it was kind of catching lightning in a bottle, perhaps, but it was a really good display of it. And so I guess the question is, or the questions are, is Tyson Fury back? Has he returned enough physically and mentally, psychologically, perhaps, to kind of recapture that form? Does he need to even recapture that form against the Deontay Wilder? You know, is he ready for this type of fight? I mean, there are a number of questions that hinge largely on Tyson Fury, too. But it sounds like before, where we were kind of dismissing Tyson Fury and saying, nah, there's no way, he hasn't shown that he can do it yet, it sounds like there's some doubt creeping into your mind after seeing Deontay Wilder, maybe.
I just think Deontay Wilder, Lennox Lewis was playing chess. Vladimir Klitschko, after Manny Stewart came over, was playing chess. Deontay Wilder is playing poker, and poker is a game of incomplete information. There's always going to be an element of chaos to determine what the results are. So that makes him a little more interesting and more exciting. Because there's he's not able to control a fight the way these other great heavyweight champions have been able to. And that, I think that will be good for fans, because it means there is an element that anybody could catch him. And he said that too. He says, I know everybody thinks if I get in there with a puncher, they're going to take me out. And I've been hit, and I showed I can come back from getting hit. But, you know, I don't know if I'm a great fighter yet. I think I have moments of it, but I don't know if I am. But I know that, you know, if I hit anybody cleanly, they're gone, whoever the hell it is. And I totally agree with it. So that's why I say, like, on the one hand, I'm just shocked at seeing such amateurishness from somebody who's been a pro for 10 years, is an Olympic bronze medalist. And yet on the other hand, there's just no denying every knife fight that he goes into, he's bringing a fucking cannon. And you know it too. This guy doesn't have knife fights. He brings a gun to every single one of them. And they have to deal with that. And that's stress. You know, that's the stress of even George Foreman at 45 years old. You get in front of one of his right hands that looks like it's in slow motion, you can end up like Michael Moore. And that is an aspect of the heavyweight division that's unlike any other sport. There's no other sport where you could become Deontay Wilder at 20 years old and start. All of these guys are prodigies. LeBron James could not have become LeBron James if he was like, I picked up a basketball at 20 years old. Magnus Carlsen wouldn't become the greatest chess player in the world if he picked up at 20. He picked up chess at 4 years old. You know, all these guys are child prodigies in order to become massively successful. And Wilder, if he was a welterweight, if he was a guy who was 5'8", would not be ranked 400th in the world, right? But as a heavyweight, he could become an undefeated, unified champion. You know, really the first one we've had since Lennox Lewis, I guess. And that's a strange thought and a strange commentary on where boxing is. And it's interesting, but it's bizarre. It's really bizarre. And I felt like I saw both extremes of him preparing to get ready for the Fury fight, which could just be the appetizer before Joshua. And there were moments where, like, I was like, oh, yeah, there's the right hand. That's why he's the most dangerous heavyweight in the world. And then there were moments where I was like, nobody walking into a gym or nobody who's been coming to a boxing gym for 3 or 4 weeks would do the thing he just did. How could he be doing that? That's not – how could that happen? So it's strange that he encompasses such extremes of ability and sort of just – he seems like an imposter at times where you're just – that's not a boxer, let alone the heavyweight champion. That's a basketball player. That's a wide receiver or something. But no, I think it's why he chose boxing. He said, I just thought you could make money quick and make an impact quick in the heavyweight division. He didn't think, you know, I need money to look after my daughter, so I'm going to rely on the sports that I'm really good at, which were basketball and football. He was like, boxing. If I do those other ones, I have to go to 4 years of college. Boxing, I can jump in. And he proved it's true. So I give him a lot of credit for it, but it's I'm still just kind of shaking my head a lot of the time about, wow, this is a really, really weird story.
It's the kind of stuff that's, you know, not strange in the world of boxing, but still, you know, pretty crazy.
Yeah. There's no, I even said it to him. I said it to his face. You're a fucking cruiserweight. If you happen to be a guy who's just a little smaller, you could never do what you're doing. Do you know that? And he was like, oh, yeah. It's like that kind of surprised me. But he's just like, no, like it's a different ball game up here with the big boys, isn't it? If you can bang, you know, and I bang better than anybody, that's why I am where I am. And there's no argument that I have to that. He's right. Who bangs better than he does? Like, you know, Ricky Martin talking about that girl. She bangs.
Oh, I thought that was William Hung.
It could be. Oh, that's right. I forgot about the American Idol guy.
So, well, it sounds like you have a little bit more time to do some Deontay Wilder bomb squad researching. So we'll have to revisit the subject when you know, get all of your information to see if anything has changed. But so a couple weeks ago when we had our last show, the bigger news was that Canelo Alvarez had signed with DAZN for a trillion dollar deal that's going to net him $14 billion over the next decade. This last weekend, though, Daniel Jacobs, he picked up the IBF middleweight belt over Sergey Derevyanchenko. So this is a fight card that had already been in the works since before HBO had announced that they were more or less out of the boxing racket. They had basically, they haven't really made any official announcement that, like, we're never doing boxing again. But what they had essentially said was that boxing is no longer going to be part of their regular programming. And that, yeah, they'll show boxing as long as the shows are worth it. So you can't really look at the Jacobs Derevyanchenko show. It doesn't really count. It was already in the works. But one they have announced in the since we last talked was Dmitry Bivol versus Jean Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of at odds with what they were saying. Jean Pascal's, I don't even want to look. I would guess 42, 43?
Yeah, he's got to be up there.
Something like that. He's obviously a fantastic athlete and, you know, overall, I think he's kind of an entertaining character and kind of eccentric. But nonetheless, the guy has gotten hammered over the course of his last, like, 10 fights a few times. And it's just kind of weird. Between Jacobs, Derevianchenko, and Bivol Pascal, you know, at least the announcement of that, anything changed in your mind as far as where HBO is going, the status, anything like that?
Well, I think people have been grossly unfair to Peter Nelson, and these kind of choices demonstrate a kind of acumen that I don't think regular people could have in terms of matchmaking. Because I was at the Jacobs fight, and I'd say I think it was the most extraordinary fight, not just in that division, but of any fight I've ever seen in my life, going back to Achilles and Hector in terms of the drama, in terms of the venue. It was just the coronation of the Nelson era. No, I mean, it was a boring fight. I wish Jacobs applied a lot more pressure. I like Jacobs a lot. Everybody I know who knows Jacobs likes him. He's a really good guy from all accounts. I've never met him personally, but you know, I love what he did going to the Kid Chocolate fight. I thought that was really exciting to watch, especially because Chocolate was a dangerous fighter. And yet there's just something about Jacobs where he just is just too inactive in there. And it's very frustrating because he has so many tools. He just doesn't use them. And so it just ends up pissing you off watching him fight more often than not because, you know, he's such an elite fighter. He's not great at any one thing, but he's so good at so many things. And yet, you know, he just doesn't pour on the pressure and wins a lot of these fucking decisions that are just – you know, I just left really frustrated. I got home at 4 o'clock in the morning after that fight, like going to the acclaimed TikTok diner just outside MSG where all the fighters go and fight people and just having a cup of coffee after. I was just so drained by it. And it's always the measure of a fight that you go to at MSG is it, when you get home at 3 or 4 in the morning, are you like, it was worth it. That was really fun. And that was a real prime example of either I'm getting really old, but I was just like, I don't know if I want to do this again. I don't want to come home at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm blind from those fucking blue lights they shine into the audience to fill up the empty seats. Because if you're not ringside in press row, and I wasn't, the blue light is just glaring at your eye like a sniper's like scope. It's so like you're blinded. The next day I had foggy eyes and the music is so loud and none of the fans are responding to the music that's playing. Like, boxing, trying to turn it into this fucking, I don't know, like this festival feeling, it's the wrong mood. Like, they're not finding the right mood for a lot of these shows. And they're trying to impose a mood to it, I guess, for the telecast of the HBO commentators. But it was just really just an unpleasant show. And another thing I want to say about Canelo is I listened to a number of other podcasts, our competitors, who made the point that Canelo, all this talk about $350 million, he's not going to fight the number of fights to earn that money. That's a way overblown figure, perhaps. But perhaps it's a low figure because – that is not the cap of what he can earn. If he does fight those fights, he could earn more than $350 million. So I think like that needs to be pointed out as well in terms of how much they invested and doubled down on Canelo to be part of DAZN. Could make more if he's able to bring the kind of audiences that he's brought. So I think that's also significant for him. But yeah, I don't know. And I'm also annoyed with HBO because all of the insiders, I listened to Jim Lampley go on Michael Woods, who's a really nice guy. I always liked him. He's always been very generous and friendly to me. And Lampley is saying what a lot of these HBO people are saying. We all knew the writing was on the wall. We knew, you know, before Nelson got here that this things could go this way. They never said that. When Nelson signed on, they all said, we're in the best hands possible. I believe in him. they said it off the record too. It wasn't just what they were publicly saying. So I'm annoyed that they're so full of shit about how they're pushing this angle of we're moving to documentaries and other kind of programming. Our subscribers, it just feels like spin. It just feels like spin, and you know, it's not the crux of my existence, but I do think they've been pretty full of shit with a lot of the commentary they've offered post facto HBO pulling out of boxing. I think they fucked up as soon as they had a number of people competing with them. I heard Lou DiBella talking about this. You know, when we had the big budget, look at where we were. Well, look how they are when other people have a big budget. How did HBO do? Read that Michael Woods article where he inventories every fight that Peter Nelson was in charge of creating and tell me how brilliant those fights were in terms of matchmaking. I think they fucked up, man. I just think they fucked up. I think they deserve a little more scrutiny than they've gotten in terms of dropping the ball. And I just mean, I understand their budget. They were limited. Their purse strings were limited. But I also just think, why aren't you trying to do some creative things that are interesting in terms of matchmaking? I just, you know, a lot of people I know in boxing that if you give them some money to put together fights, I think they could have done a much, much better job than was done. And I don't know why more people aren't sort of talking about that rather than just saying, oh, it's the direction HBO's going. It was a corporate decision that was over Nelson's head and all that. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I do think that it was largely over his head and it was the direction they were going in. But looking back, there were obviously decisions to air fights that just don't make sense. Or if it wasn't the fights themselves, it was the presentation of them or the way that they went about doing it. And the fact that they had kind of, at a time where it was just kind of the worst time for it, put their foot down and said they weren't working with certain entities in the sport, probably at the behest of other entities in the sport. Man, yeah, HBO has not really made good decisions in boxing in a while. And whether it's directly his responsibility or not, dude, the captain goes down with the ship, and that's just kind of how it is. So that's kind of how I see it, whether you can, a lot of it can be directly attributed to Nelson or not. Some of it can. Some of it kind of is just the stuff that he was given. But he's still going to have to face I don't even know how much he's going to have to face, because if HBO is truly kind of walking away from boxing, then to them it might just be a non-factor. They're like, well, it's just part of our programming that we're not doing anymore, so Nelson gets to move on to something else, I would guess.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There's a definite golden parachute there for him. But I wanted to ask you, a number of people I've heard when they talk about the fall of HBO, I found it strange that there was they were attributing it, the beginning of the downfall was hiring Max Kellerman and really getting rid of Larry Merchant. And I was just curious about your take on that. I like Max Kellerman on the show. I think he's goofy and silly, and his know-it-all antics are not very endearing. I love Larry Merchant as a color commentator. I think it's always a good move to have writers and people who speak in paragraphs rather than some of the other people they bring in that are, you know, really challenged. I don't mean HBO, but I mean like other outlets calling a fight where it's just like the Mauro Ranallo screaming thing. He is a sweet guy and I like him, but I can't stand listening to that. I just can't. I know a lot of people like it, and that's cool if they do. There's a lot of, you know, I'm listening to a lot of music here. I don't want to listen to it. Like, I wouldn't listen to it at home, but I like that they like it. I like people enjoying stuff, but I don't want to fucking listen to Mauro Ranallo.
And he nails him with a shot to the peninsula south of the equator.
Yeah, yeah. I'm on Fuego. No, you're not on Fuego. You were born 40 miles from where I am in Vancouver. So don't say on Fuego. You're not, you don't have that privilege to ever, ever say that. Patrick does because he's married to a Mexican. And even there, it's questionable. It's a little bit
questionable.
You got to be a little bit careful. I, I did a podcast the other day. I thought of you, Brian Koppelman, the guy who created Billions, and he made a point saying, I bet you were really smart kid in school or something. I was like, they actually had me evaluated for retardation. For they thought I was a retard. And he was like, you didn't just say retard, did you? I was like, oh, no. oh, here it comes. Oh, God. But that was the word they used at that time. But I thought, no, that's not a word you use anymore. And I saw Shaun White just went as what was it, Simple Jack for a Halloween costume. So I was like, ugh. So
it's like,
I don't want.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, I realized that I was probably about to get off track for like 90 seconds. But I mean, it's a tough subject because I want to respect when somebody is offended and I want to acknowledge if somebody is, but I also don't want to fall into a trap of acknowledging when anybody's offended by fucking everything or anything to the point where life just stops. So I'm kind of like, it's tough. You know, I do not want to demean anybody, like anybody who is handicapped or disabled, less than capable, whatever the fuck you want to call it. But it's tenuous, dude. It's a rough one. It's a tough line.
No, it totally is. And you know what is, I think kids begin by being mean. They start off being mean to people. The kids are terribly, terribly mean. Kids don't start off with innocence. Like, yeah, maybe innocence is another word for being ignorant, but largely they're cruel in ignorance as well because they don't know its impact. I remember when I was 3 years old and moved to a new neighborhood, and the first time I saw an Asian kid was at a corner store. He was a teenager, and when I was with my father buying candy or something or milk, it was literally the first time I'd ever seen an Asian person, and I said, why are his eyes like that? What's going on? And my dad was like, do you understand what you're saying? Like, that's wrong. And I saw that it hurt the person's feelings so much that I'm like, this is racism. I've discovered racism. I've met somebody who doesn't look like me, and it was so painful to know that I had not even intended to do any harm, and I completely did. I completely othered somebody. And you just think, hopefully we can admit that we have these parts of ourselves that are clumsy or worse, but we do something to fix them, right? Hopefully early on. But I agree with you. I also think there's a fascist component to political correctness where – do you want no comedy in the world? Do you want, like, it's that joke about liberals that, like, they want freedom of everything except if you disagree with them on anything. And I've noticed that, and it's definitely adjusted my calibration politically, is that a lot of the people who agree with me politically, I don't like the spokesman for those issues. I find them repulsive very often, even though I'm totally with them on what they're fighting for in so many ways. And that's kind of a strange place to be. Political correctness, I mean, even boxing, like, part of me when I go to the fights, I feel a little bit embarrassed. I'm watching two half-naked people beat the fuck out of each other. But then you can contextualize it and the drama of it, the theater of it, and all those kind of things. But I'm – you know, at the fights, I'm aware a lot of the people who were walking by when I was at the Jacobs fight, I had really bad seats for that fight. My friend had seats, and so we're way back. And a lot of people back there are dressed so ridiculously, and they're drunk, and there's always a fight about to break out and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just like, this is also a part of what I'm involved with is it's an excuse to get off on the testosterone and violence. Yeah. And all that shit. And I was just kind of like, oh God. And I'm not better than that. You know, I just feel weird about it and conflicted. And,
but this is also something that there are going to be people who listen into the show for certain things or listen into podcasts or boxing shows for certain things they're going to listen to the shows that we do, and they're going to be like, this is the most boring shit I've ever heard. Where is the cussing? Where's the, you know, like, where's the arguing? Where's the calling people gay? And where's the, you know, the sound bites and all this type of stuff? And that's cool. But the entire point of, like, when I had first started this thing with Foley a couple years ago was that I want to be able to talk about these issues in boxing and as a fan or whatever that cause cognitive dissonance. Shit that other fans yeah. don't talk about and other shows don't talk about because they don't know how to talk about them. And the idea of the ridiculousness behind even being a boxing fan is something I try to address often because I feel like it is ridiculous. I just kind of want to like step back and be like, look at yourself. Look at what we're all doing and talking about. Like, what are we doing? But that doesn't mean I'm going to stop. It just means that I just want to make sure that every so often I step back and say, just think about what you're watching. Think about what you're promoting and what you're getting behind. And then go back to it. But just think about it for a minute. You know?
Well,
it's weird. Well, some of the stuff we do and talk about is fucking weird.
No question. And I guess what I'm in opposition to about the nature of political correctness is the ultimate objection you can have right now is whatever it is that offends you, it makes me uncomfortable. I feel uncomfortable. And I just think, well, all growth involves moving into the unknown, and the unknown is always going to be intrinsically uncomfortable. So it's kind of saying a little bit, if you don't want to be uncomfortable, you want to stay safe in being exactly the same way and forcing the world to conform to your level of what makes you feel balanced and safe and emotionally stable and all that. And it's just, there's a lot of stuff out there we can't control. And I'm not saying we shouldn't try to make the world more hospitable and nurturing and caring and sensitive and all that. I am for those things. And I'm for trying to go against abuse and Megyn Kelly is being taken to task where she's bringing up some obscure place in England that's banning Halloween costumes and stuff. And then she starts immediately going to blackface and defending blackface costumes. Like, what a weird mind she has for it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm dating a woman.
God damn it. You know, I just want to be able to wear my Ku Klux Klan uniform in peace. Okay. Like, Jesus Christ, people. Jesus, okay?
But you just hear these things and you just think, like, if you have a lot of friends who are African American and they discuss to you what it's like to be profiled, what it's like to walk into their apartment building and have white people be like, what are you doing here? And that sort of thing. And we're seeing more and more cases of this because they're getting filmed or police stopping them. When I was in Cuba, if I'd ever walk with a black Cuban, he'd always be like, get ready to be stopped by every single policeman. And I'd say, well, no, like all my other friends I walk with, that never happens. Yeah, are they black? Absolutely right. And it's just what's totally normal for somebody outside of your realm of experience is just so jarring. And
well,
I don't know.
These kind of experiences, one would hope, as awful as they are, I don't want to call them necessary in the broader sense, but necessary in terms of understanding and necessary in terms of growth and growing beyond ignorance. And this is how I would assume you get rid of racism, is showing people these experiences and making sure they understand that these things exist. But, you know, it's difficult when some people don't want to listen.
And I think like bringing it home as it's germane to boxing, one of the things I love about boxing is like I go to watch Deontay Wilder spar before a fight. I'm learning about somebody who's from the South in a state that I've only passed through once. And I'm learning about his relationship to growing up here and what that meant. And the feeling of possibilities that his peer group had, how dangerous it was for him to be drawn into a criminal element because he said, if I'm going to go into boxing, I'm going to become the heavyweight champion. Had I gone into drug dealing, I would have become a kingpin. I wouldn't have been on a street corner. I wouldn't have stopped until I was at the level, the same way I approach boxing. That's the way I approach everything. I began as an assistant with Budweiser. Very soon I had to be driving a truck. I couldn't stop moving up and moving up and moving up. That's the way I am, which I thought was very interesting. He's got three sparring partners there. One of them is from Kazakhstan. The other is from New Zealand. The other, I think, is from Los Angeles. You're learning so much about different places and different people, and they're coming together, and reporters are there from England. So it's like that's a thing that boxing does do, is it forces you to put a face on places, different experiences. You learn about their wives. Maybe their wives are from a different place. You learn about their families. The New Zealand guy was telling you about David Tua, the Maori experience in New Zealand. He's talking about race over there. You had a few years ago the Puerto Rican boxer who came out as gay, openly gay, wearing rainbow trunks. That's quite a brave thing to do in the boxing world, especially the way the outside looks at the boxing world is so machismo and homophobic. So I think that these speak well of boxing and introducing things and putting a face on them. And I think that that's how, with these issues, instead of them being abstract, boxing confronts things in very interesting ways to catch people off guard with stuff that they wouldn't otherwise access that information. And same with sports writing, frankly. I always, you wrote a book about Cuban boxers, Cuban boxing. And I'm like, yeah, but it's really about people, and it's really about boxers, but I'm not doing boxing history. I'm trying to look at colonialism, racism, the slave trade, communism, capitalism, human smuggling to get these guys to the U.S., the health of the American dream, the health of the Cuban Revolution, external dynamics, the Spanish-American War, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, inequality in Cuba.
And that's all that writing really is the words are just a vehicle to, transfer something else. And that's the entire point of it. And if somebody can't understand that, then, well, there's no fucking point in trying to explain that. But I was going to ask.
And we need
go ahead.
We just need a little bit of distance. If I say that that's going to be a sports story and you're going to go on the story of some great Cuban boxer, it's easier than saying, I've written a fucking PhD thesis on the health of the Cuban Revolution in relation to the American dream and human smuggling in contrast to the origins of the slave trade from the Ivory Coast to the slave auction center of the New World in Havana, Cuba. Everybody wants to read the sports story of that. They don't want to read the academic paper, right? Because they know, like, this is going to keep the pages turning, hopefully, if it's a sports story. It's just like sugar on top of the oatmeal or cinnamon on top of the oatmeal as opposed to, no, it's just going to be oatmeal. It's just going to be like Eastern Bloc gruel that you're going to eat of data and figures and all that. So I like how sports does that. I don't feel embarrassed to be like, I'm a sports writer. It's lower than something else. I think it offers all kinds of opportunities to reach people that other stuff doesn't in a more pompous, elitist kind of way.
Well, I sure hope so.
I hope so.
Well, I was going to ask you, before we close it all down in a couple minutes, I was going to ask you, though, did you get to watch I think you kind of already answered, actually. You didn't get to watch the Jacobs fight with Hauser. Or have you been able to talk to him about it or anything?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I watched it with Kurt Emhoff, but I saw Hauser, I think, the week before, but no.
What is his take on the HBO fading away stuff?
He said he was naturally aware of sort of what was written on the wall for some time. I was like, oh, news to me. But he just thinks that there's boxing's in a very strange place, and it's it's realigning, and the pay-per-view model needed some adjustment, and so he's really not sure where it's going to go. But as he sees it, these factions are too divided to make the fights that people want to see, and that's the major obstacle in boxing, is it's not producing the best fighting the best, and that this may have made some things harder, you know, for some of those big fights to happen, like Wilder and Joshua. You know, is Canelo Golovkin like getting the rubber match? Is that going to happen? There could be obstacles to that with where this is going. So, I haven't extensively sort of tapped him on the subject, but he did bring it up, and I did say, as somebody who's an advisor at HBO, like, where does that leave you? This is pretty dramatic stuff. So, yeah, no big blazing takeaways there.
Yeah, no big reveals or anything. I was just curious. But I do have to give some credit here to Mike Coppinger, because as far as I know, unless somebody else broke it first or said it first, yesterday he had reported that DAZN was actually actively pursuing Gennady Golovkin as, you know, bringing him into their stable, which would mean they pretty much have the middleweight division on lockdown. Because when we had talked about before with the whole DAZN thing and acquiring Canelo, it was like, well, I guess there goes the rubber match, or, well, I guess technically a rubber match since it was a draw, then a loss. But, you know, there goes the third fight with Golovkin. That's what I thought. But if they acquire Golovkin, then that's going to be quite different. And even if they acquire him and they go forward with Canelo versus Jacobs, as they might do, anyway, fairly interesting stuff in the meanwhile from DAZN. But as far as Daniel Jacobs goes, I totally agree with what you were saying earlier. I forgot to kind of reply to that, too. I like Daniel Jacobs. Good story. Seems like a nice dude. But just, I just want him to do more in the ring. He seems to put away the scrubs totally fine. But then beyond that, I mean, even just a Sergio Mora type in that first fight. I mean, it was like, why, what business do you have getting knocked down by Sergio Mora at middleweight? And then, I don't know, it doesn't really make any sense. And then, you know, going life and death with Gennady Golovkin. I don't know. It's frustrating, like you said.
Yeah, and it's a shame, because I feel like he has all the tools to be something pretty special. And he looked in the best shape I'd ever seen him going into that fight. But, I just came away very disappointed. I'm not trying to criticize him, because I have a lot of respect for what he does. But I just thought, God, like, this is not somebody I want to see again after this performance. This is, you know, it's very similar with fighters to, if you're somebody like me that is very consistent with the kind of, like, food that they like, or places they like to eat, I always order the same thing, and I always look forward to that, to enjoying that again. And I'm that way with fighters too. If I find, it's like a person who cooks something a way I really like, I just enjoy it so much to come back the next time. But the one time you eat there and everything starts going wrong a little bit, things are kind of just, it's just not as good. The service is falling off. The quality of the food has fallen off. Oh, we don't have this sauce. We've switched over to this one or whatever. You're just kind of like, do I want to go back there again? And that's how I felt a little bit with Jacobs, is he's given me like the kid chocolate thing. I was just like, wow, I had no idea he could do this. But in so many other fights, I just think, do I really want to see him again? If I hear that he's headlining a fight, does that really make me want to go watch? I'd rather, you know, stay home with a cat than spend 5 hours with an undercard and go deaf the next day and be blind, because I don't feel like he's trying to put on something special. And I'm not saying that everybody needs to have that expectation, but I've seen enough boxing live in my life that, like, I'm not chasing that dragon so much anymore. I'm happy. I really enjoy boxing, and I really enjoy seeing guys fight and seeing people get into stuff. And I accept that probably 90% of the time you're not wowed by what you're seeing. That's okay, because when you do get wowed, it's still amazing. But my takeaway from this was just a lot of, like, I don't know that I need to see – he needs to do something to make me want to go back to see him again. And I felt like I wasn't alone in that feeling.
Or it would have to be a much better matchup or something like that. On paper, the Derevyanchenko fight was a good fight. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't the type of shit we've been salivating for years or anything like that. But it was definitely at worst on the level of like, well, if this is what we got, then this is pretty good. You know, this is making lemonade out of lemons as far as we can do, you know. But even so, there needed to be more from Daniel Jacobs, separating him from Derevyanchenko, showing that he deserves these bigger fights or that we want to see him in these bigger fights. I still do, because I know what he's capable of, but not based off of that performance, surely. And if anybody would have seen that performance or seen him for the first time in that performance, they probably would have walked away just shrugging. Like, eh, whatever.
Yeah, it just wasn't. And you know the other thing? I have to be honest, like, Heather Hardy is the most boring fucking fighter to watch. I mean, I think that set up the Jacobs thing where I was just in a bad mood. I like Heather Hardy. I like the story. I respect her. I never, ever, ever want to watch Heather Hardy fight because she can't punch. It's like Pauly Malignaggi as a female fighter, and I just can't stand, you know, the moment the fight starts. Why is that a 12-round fight? Why? It's a pillow fight in terms of the impact of the blows, and you watch your face get swollen up and all that. But I just, it's just so predictable, the outcome every time you watch it, that it drives me crazy. So I'm always just like, oh God. And I'm not anti women fighters. Serrano is really fun to watch. I really enjoy watching her fight. But I find the Heather Hardy thing, the narrative does not sell the fight. It's really good sauce on really bad food. And I always just end up going, like, I feel gross after this because I'm bored out of my fucking mind.
In my opinion, and I'm trying to tread carefully here, because we've talked about women's boxing before, and I'm trying
to
do it
in a respectful way. And I get into trouble, I know.
Well, whatever. I'm not so worried about that part, but I mean, just in terms of describing it and in terms of like giving credence to it, I feel as though the style that Heather Hardy brings, when you add that to the outside the ring like narrative part of it, it's a little bit more of a stereotype than is fair to women's boxing, because her outside the ring narrative kind of gets pushed as check out this beautiful brawler type of thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. The only thing wrong with it is that it's kind of a trope. But then in the ring, she's not particularly skilled. She's not unskilled, but she's not particularly skilled, and she can't punch. So it winds up kind of just being, you know, you punch, I punch, you punch, I punch, you punch, I punch. And if neither of us has much punching power, then this is what it's going to be until somebody's face falls apart or somebody doesn't want to do it anymore or something. I mean, in those type of fights, there's a place for them. That's cool. But when they're predictable from a certain fighter, like if this is somebody's fight every single fight, it's not really my thing personally, and I don't blame anybody if it's not their thing either. And so again, when you add the outside the ring narrative to it and the fact that it's kind of like redundant, and I don't blame her, I just feel like it's lazy promoting overall. I understand, because promoters have not known what to do with women boxers for literally decades. I don't blame them per se, because this is just kind of how it's been with promoting women's boxing for literally decades. But that being said, unless somebody's going to be promoting it better, I don't really have much interest. I'm just, you know, being honest. I don't have much interest in this story specifically.
No, I just felt amazingly bored and resentful sitting there because, and I say, it's not a knee-jerk reaction to a women's boxing match. And I think the MMA with women has been much better, like promoted. And I think, I don't know, there's just more of an exciting dynamic to it because, like, Heather Hardy, for example, and I think she reminds me of Malignaggi in some respects, like watching a Malignaggi fight where he's not fighting a puncher, is just that she's not fighting an opponent that's particularly skilled, and she can't put an opponent who's unskilled away. So you're just there for 12 rounds to just
yeah.
Every moment of every round is heartbreakingly predictable. And she doesn't even use, like, when you're watching her punch, she's an arm puncher for the entire fight.
Yeah.
She doesn't,
yeah,
there's no hip.
She's off balance quite a bit. Like, she's kind of, there's
yeah,
a lot of,
bad.
And she doesn't really move her head much. And that's what I mean. That's what I'm saying when I say she doesn't have no skill. Like, it's, but she's not super skilled. A lot of the things that you would, and this is where, like I said, I kind of try to tread carefully, but just putting it plainly for time's sake, this is the kind of thing where if you saw this from a male fighter, you would say, what level of fighter am I watching? Like, why is this on my television? But
yeah, and,
this is not yeah. the fault of a woman's fighter. And you brought up the mixed martial arts kind of a, you know, analogy a moment ago. A lot of that is because the development of skill in mixed martial arts, I think that it part of it is that it's probably a little bit more conducive to, you know, the kind of ergonomics and anatomy of fighting. Oh, I don't know if I want to go down that fucking road. Never mind. Point is, the development of skill in mixed martial arts for women has clearly been leaps and bounds in a very short period of time and compared to boxing, where there have only really been a handful of fighters in the last couple of decades that you could name that have been skilled to the point where you could say they're just world-class, period. Lucia Riker, you know, very skilled fighter.
Yep.
Clarissa Shields, she's pretty skilled currently. Serrano
absolutely,
sisters,
absolutely.
Also very skilled. So it's not to totally trash women's boxing, period. It's just, I don't think that it's really encouraged. I don't really think that there's much infrastructure for it. There's not really anything, any farm system creating fighters or anything like that. Whereas in mixed martial arts, I think there are just far more opportunities for those kinds of things, especially because it's not just boxing as a single discipline, but wrestling, judo, jiu-jitsu, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all things that people can get into that lead into one thing, whereas in boxing, it's all specialized. And so perhaps that's an issue too. Anyway, I feel you on the Hardy situation.
I just think it's a little bit like with Ronda Rousey, like her rise, she's taking everybody out, she's choking them, she's punching them out. You don't know what's going to happen in the ways that she's dispatching all these opponents. And then the upset was so dramatic of her losing. She's going to make her big comeback. You get another phenomenally exciting way in which she loses. But I feel like there's an element of, like you're saying, with mixed martial arts, you get the wow factor of the knockout being a possibility that's dangling to you as a viewer all the time. With boxing, you just don't feel like it's there with a lot of women's boxing. It's not part of it's not a component very often with fighters like Heather Hardy.
And that's not unfair to bring up because it's a fact. Like, and that is something that affects the entertainment value.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, similarly, you can really appreciate basketball and love everything to do with basketball, but for a number of people, the only thing they like about basketball is slam dunks. And if you're somebody that's completely oriented to a game played above the rim, the WNBA is going to be grossly lesser fair than men playing basketball. That's what you're oriented towards. And I don't think you should be oriented to that, but it means that if you're looking for highlight reel dunks, that's the wrong place to go. And I think similarly for boxing, yeah, it's just to lose that from the equation of a fight, that at any moment a one punch can make the difference. And of course it still can, but you just don't even feel it as a threat when you're watching Hardy fight. It just felt to me like there's no way either of these women are going to get dropped by anything they're throwing, because they're not throwing anything with any degree of velocity to hurt each other. They're certainly getting swollen and they're doing damage. I'm not saying it's not dangerous what they're doing, but I just thought, my God, I would actively avoid anything to do with this woman if I have to sit through fucking 30 minutes of it. It was just so boring.
Yeah, it was not particularly useful way to spend the time, in my opinion. But some people might be into it, and if they are, bless them.
And nothing wrong with
that.
They're not me. Yeah, nothing wrong with that. And I hope the basketball analogy is in some way apropos, but maybe even discussing it, you're just a fucking asshole. I don't know, but I just.
Well, if we start bringing up the WNBA, then maybe it starts to get a little more asshole-ish.
Well, I think it's – I'm so pro this working. I just want it to be successful, and yet that was a really, really bad exhibition of female boxing. If there was somebody who was just coming to a boxing fight and they said, is this what all women boxing is? It's a bad fucking look. Objectively,
yeah,
like if you care about the health of making that a sustainable business, of not having really good boxers like Heather Hardy move over to the MMA because it's the only place they can make money, this is not the way to do it. This is not. I've seen a number of women fights that it absolutely was exciting. It was very dramatic, and it was different from men boxing in ways that made it unique and made it compelling. Just like I think Ronda Rousey is the great character in the MMA, transcended the entire sport. She was not just bigger than any female MMA fighter. She was bigger than the entire sport, all men. And I don't think even Serena Williams did that with tennis. So she deserves a lot of credit for that, both in the ring and the way she marketed herself. And I'd love for that to happen in boxing. Heather Hardy and that as a blueprint is not it.
Totally. Yeah. Well, we'll have to figure out what the blueprint is, try to get it from Oscar De La Hoya before our next show.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Well, I mean, and there's not a ton, there's not a ton as far as big name stuff going on in the next week. But, hey, we got some stuff from DAZN, we got some ESPN+, and we got some Facebook Watch. So this really goes, it melds directly into this conversation of the app stuff and HBO fading out of the sport and all that type of stuff. So anyway, it's interesting things, and we'll, I'm sure, be back in the next week or so to talk about that type of stuff. But I got a jet. Sorry to abruptly bring it to a close. But hey, everybody, thank you for hanging through our awkward discussion of women's boxing and HBO and whatnot. We appreciate it. If you're on Twitter, go on there and follow Bryn at Brynicio, B-R-I-N-I-C-I-O, and me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. And if you're on Facebook, go onto Facebook and like Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio on Facebook. That helps us. And also, what helps us is if you're listening on iTunes, go into there. There's a little way to rate the show. Give us a rating, maybe write a sentence or two in the little comment box, because we like that, and it's feeds our ego in some way. And yeah, we'll figure out some way to embarrass you online or something. We'll see. Bryn, we'll talk soon, bud.
Thanks, man. Talk to you soon.
All right, man. Take it easy, everybody.